Hi everyone, this is David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 36, Fantastic Fiction, and this week we're going to continue with our series of interviews with some of the very top indie authors in the business. Today we're going to talk with USA Today best-selling author Karpov Kinraid, and it was a fantastic interview. I think you're going to get a lot out of it, and I've got some more great authors lined up coming up soon, so going to have some opportunities to learn from those who are really killing it in indie fiction right now. Not a whole lot happening in the publishing world to talk about. One thing that's sort of a follow-up on something we mentioned a few weeks ago. We discussed that some authors were having their erotica titles taken off of certain stores, and I believe it was Nook Press was closing accounts, sometimes without notice, because of titles that were in someone's dashboard. And it appeared that basically what it was a lot of authors were presenting books that had questionable content that often violated terms of service from some of the stores where they were publishing, and sometimes they were just tagging it, categorizing these works differently to try and get away with it, and stores little by little are cracking down. And recently, authors got a letter from Smashwords letting them know they're not closing accounts. Smashwords is one of the last holdouts for, I guess some would call it free speech, where you can publish a lot of controversial things on Smashwords, and they're not going to be the judge. However, what they have done, because Smashwords distributes to just about all of the big vendors, is they are adding new categories so that people can be very specific about what content is in their books, and so they will not accidentally distribute these books to vendors who don't want them. And I have a feeling that from now on, authors who try to get away with things that they know they shouldn't, now that these tags are there and they're required to use them, think they could risk even losing their Smashwords account if they don't follow the rules. But one of the helpful things is they provided a chart showing the different types of content that can be questionable and who accepts them. And basically, pretty much everybody but Biblioteca and Overdrive accept mainstream erotic, general sexy stories. Then you have something called dubious consent. And I'm kind of learning this as I go because I don't read it or write it, which is it's kind of on the edge of rape, but it's not. Most places still allow this, but some do not. And then you move into what they call incest and pseudo-incest, which I believe pseudo-incest is like you have non-biologically related siblings or parents and children. So it's icky and to a lot of people weird, but it's technically not, they're not genetically related, these characters who are having sexual relations. Sorry, I just sounded like Bill Clinton there. But anyway, apparently there for a while you could get away with the step relative incest stories on a lot of these retailers. Well, now, according to their chart, just about everyone has banned it. Tolino allows it, Inkterra, and Smashwords, and that's it. Same with bestiality. Same with age play, which I guess, see, I'm having to read this as I go. Like I said, I don't read it. It's when you have consenting adults, but one of them is pretending to be a child or a baby. So again, to a lot of people, icky. A couple of vendors still allow that, but the trend appears to be getting rid of that too. And then rape for titillation and sexual slavery. I don't think I need to explain those. And just about everyone has banned that, and Smashwords even has those two as being discouraged. Now, at this point, Smashwords doesn't disallow anything in those categories. I'm sure there's probably some really over-the-top stuff they wouldn't permit. But anyway, it looks like it's getting tougher and tougher to write in the edgier erotica categories. I know for a while, this was several years ago, before Amazon started up putting erotica or certain types of erotica behind sort of a virtual wall where it was difficult to find in search engines and things like that. A lot of the erotic authors, especially writing the step family stuff, they were killing it. And I don't know how they're doing now with so many places not even willing to distribute it. So Anyway, if that's something you're thinking about writing, check out the Smashwords blog. You can find a copy of that letter that went out. And just, you know, make yourself aware of what is permitted, what isn't. Be careful about the way you tag your work. And maybe explore other venues. Surely there are places where you can sell this specific type stuff. And what my guess would be is as the mainstream ebook retailers refuse to carry this stuff, the audience doesn't go away. So it could be that there's still a lot of people who are really interested, and maybe, assuming it hasn't already happened, some bookstore is going to step in, ebook store that is, and fill that gap. So anyway, that was just a follow-up on something we talked about. And related content, like most authors, I'm involved in a few book and writing related groups. And yesterday someone posted in one of the groups that when he writes sex scenes, he only uses the proper names for body parts. Because according to him, when you don't use the proper names, the book does not seem serious. And he refers to these as porn novels. And says that they are written for readers with low reading levels. And then, of course, the classic, don't read the comments, but I did anyway. There were some people who chimed in and said that sex scenes are unnecessary and they take away from the story and things like that. But then some people made some valid points. So I thought I would just touch base and share my opinions. And again, I don't write erotica. I'd probably be terrible at it because I don't read it. And I haven't studied, you know, what it is the reader's looking for and how to do it well. But first of all, unless Sheldon Cooper is your point of view character, I don't think that using the clinical terms is the way to go. I mean, typically with my books, we might suggest that there's going to be sex, but it happens off screen. I think in Primordial, I seem to remember the characters. Maybe we showed a little foreplay before we faded to black. But anyway, first of all, yeah, I don't know that using the medical terms... Okay, I'm getting out of order here. One of the commenters said, I write in first person, so I need to write it in the words the character would use. Well, that's true, but I want to add that even if you're writing in a tight third person, because some of the commenters said, well, I write in third person, so I don't use euphemisms. Well, a tight third person is still a reflection of your point of view character. And this can manifest in word choices. It manifests in the things that the character notices. Now, I'm not saying that you should write it in the exact way the character speaks. That's a bad idea. But the reader should be able to feel whose point of view they're in, even if they don't know yet. You know, a character who is who grew up on a farm will walk into a store and maybe notice certain things that a character who grew up in the city, you know, different things they'll notice. Anyway, look for opportunities to express whose point of view you're in and to let it shape some of your word choices. And I think that, you know, a sex scene, that would be one example where your point of view character will determine the way you write it and the words you choose. The Sheldon Cooper will use the clinical terms. Someone who has maybe had no experience and maybe hasn't watched porn or read any erotica, somebody who doesn't know all the words might use a different choice of words than someone who's experienced or someone who watches a lot of porn, someone who... you can make your word choices reflect the way the person regards sex or regards the opposite sex. Maybe you've got a misogynistic character and the words inside his head in that third person point of view will express maybe his disdain or loathing or, you know, reflect a degrading attitude. But anyway, moving out of first person doesn't mean that your point of view character has no impact on the narrative. That can be for sex scenes or anything else. I also object to this author's characterization that writing erotic fiction or fiction with strong erotic content makes the author in any way less skilled or that the readers are less intelligent or less educated. Frankly, it's just absurd. Subject matter has nothing to do with skill. And just because someone enjoys sexual content doesn't mean that they don't read widely. I think people have this idea that people who like erotica are just bored people who never leave the house and they just read anything as long as there's romance and sex in it. And that's not true. There are plenty of authors trying to write erotic fiction or fiction with strong erotic content who are failing, who are not selling, even ones with great book covers and things like that. There is a skill to it. And in our interview, actually, today, we're not going to specifically talk about erotica, but we're going to talk about, you know, what it takes to reach the reader and that it's more than just writing a good book. And then it also reminded me, something else that I think I did mention in the interview that you'll be hearing in a minute, is I notice again and again people, usually people who are failing in their current genre, they'll go on a site like KBoards and announce, I'm going to write erotica. And of course, immediately some of the writers who are doing well in that category or erotic romance, they'll start by saying, okay, I recommend you read this, this, and this, and study this author and this author. And again and again, these writers from other genres say, no, I don't like reading it. I'm not interested in it. But they're so convinced that other genres are just intrinsically superior to genres with erotic content that they think they can just sit down and write it. And that's a recipe for failure. So, yeah, get off your high horse. Don't just assume that erotic content means the writing is weak or directed at, you know, a less intelligent or less critical audience. And whatever you're going to write, whatever subject matter, whatever genre, study it. So that's my sort of a mini rant for this week, not too intense. As far as my own writing goes, pretty much I'm staying the course. Third draft complete on the first Super Secret Project book and beginning to brainstorm the second one. And it's short novel length, so I'm hoping to crank another one out soon, although I think I'm going to jump back into Dane Matic first. My original plan with the Super Secret Project was to write three and then put them out. I've changed my mind about that, but I'm not going to talk about my reasons just yet. At some point down the road, I'm going to look back and analyze what I did and what my motivations were. But anyway, first book is just about ready to go. It's being beta read right now. And trying to figure out what I want to do with Dane Matic. For the longest time, I've had a certain plot that I had some problems with, but it was mostly worked out. But it's funny, we talked recently about falling in love with new ideas, and I'm pretty good about not doing that. I just write down my ideas and save them for later, and I've got these huge, huge lists of possible ideas or bits and pieces that I can use in Matic stories. And it's funny, every time I'm ready to start a new one, when I start looking at them, I'm not so enthused, and I want to find something new. So I've spent the morning researching a part of the world where I've never sent the team. But it's a maybe, because I also know that since this part of the world, it's new to me and it's interesting, emotionally, I'm going to be tempted to dive right in. But I'm writing down some ideas for this, and I'm going to let it settle. But I want to jump into another Matic book and then Super Secret Project, maybe work on both, probably not. And then, of course, my little For the Love thing I'm doing a few minutes each day. Still working bits and pieces on a Matic Kindle world that I've actually had for a while. But anyway, I find that I can only critique other people's writing in my universe in short periods. Otherwise, I find myself trying to dissect every sentence, every paragraph, every little bit. It's very slow going, and I'm not sure that a lot of what I'm offering is productive. So I take it in bits and pieces and take time to reflect on it. That is things that I was not involved in the creation of. If I created the big outline and story beats and passed it along, it's very familiar when I read the first draft that the co-author completed. So anyway, this one's a little more challenging, but working on that too. And I know the person who wrote it is listening, so sorry it's not ready, but I'm getting there. Won't be too much longer. And so that is my writing life in terms of publishing. Looks like all of the Matic audiobook bundles are out as of today. The first one's doing pretty well. Primordial is also, audiobook is also off to a great start. So we'll see what we can do about these other audiobook bundles and then report back to you. So that's it for me for this week, and let's move right on into our interview with Karpov Kinraid. We are here with author Karpov Kinraid. Welcome to Wood on Words.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Now, you are a best-selling author in fantasy. Tell us a little bit about your work, who you are, and what you do.
Well, my name is actually Lux. My husband and I, Dimitri, write together under the name of Karpov Kinraid, which is our hyphenated last name that we took when we married. And we write fantasy, science fiction, and suspense. We also have other pen names where we write other genres. Our best-selling series is the Vampire Girls series, which at this point is what most people know us by. And we've got a lot more coming out soon. I'm not sure what else to say about all that, but that's generally who we are.
Okay, so you have even more going on than I was aware of. Well, let's kind of get started. Just tell us about your journey into indie publishing.
Well, several years ago, I actually applied for a job with a small publisher as an editor. And I got the job, and they found out I had a book that I had just written, and they wanted to publish it. So I published with them, and I published... That was Forbidden Mind, and I published that trilogy and then a four-book children's fantasy series with them. And at that point, my husband and I were working together, and we realized that we could do a lot more on our own. I was also their marketing director at the time, and realized that the advice they weren't taking from me, I wanted to take for myself. So we formed our own publishing company, Daring Books. And the first series that we put out under Daring Books is the Seduce Saga, which is now under one of our pen names, Alex Lux. But it, within a few months, made us full-time authors.
Wow.
From the first two books that we launched. So we thought we had basically struck gold and felt like millionaires the day that first paycheck came in with Amazon.
So I know my experience being a hybrid, I do have couple things under another publishing house, and one of my frustrations was that even though this publisher is willing to ask me for advice on marketing, because of the way they distribute, they can't do a lot of the things that indies are able to do, like make use of AMS ads or be flexible with their discounting. Did you find that it was restrictive to be with a publisher?
I did. I think it was good initially to kind of, I don't know, get my training wheels off. But as we learned more and more about marketing ourselves and kind of all aspects, I was also really, really dirt poor at the beginning, so I couldn't afford anything myself. I don't know if you're allowed to swear on your podcast.
Oh, yes.
To keep my language clean. We
no
are,
need.
Okay. So I didn't know shit about anything at that point except how to write. And over the course of a few years, my husband and I learned a lot. He does all of our cover art. He's an amazing graphic artist. And we made our own book trailer. He's a recording. He does recording and is a producer for music and a composer. And so we, like, everything we do is all in-house at this point. And when we got to the point where we could do all that by ourselves, we realized we didn't need a publisher. And the flexibility of being able to shuffle things, retitle things, change a cover, discount, advertise here or there, put out books quickly, all of the things that really get slowed down with a trad publisher or even a smaller publisher, we really enjoyed doing ourselves. And we enjoyed the control and the influence that we had in our own creative work. And I think that is single-handedly what took us from, you know, making enough to maybe afford a cup of coffee, not at Starbucks, to to being able to, like, you know, live a pretty comfortable life now.
Yes, I sort of track my progress because I actually started back in the days when self-publishing was just an overpriced paperback on Lulu, and it was, can I, you know, buy a cup of coffee, and then the next quarter it was, can I take my family out to dinner, and then, oh, I can pay the electric bill. But like you, I'll never forget when all of a sudden I woke up and like, wow, this is a whole lot better than what I'm doing right now. But, you know, for some folks like you, it happens right away, and for some of us like me, it takes forever. What do you think it was about your work that just clicked with an audience from the start? Any idea?
Well, we have always done a lot to kind of understand what sells and what doesn't and why. Not that we have any kind of magic formula. We'd be a lot richer if we did. But I think studying the genres that we're interested in writing, and we've written in a lot of genres, which a lot of people will tell you is no, brand yourself, stick to one for a while. We broke all those rules, and for better or for worse, and there was good things and bad things about it. The good thing is we learned a lot about what we like to write. The bad thing is it's a bit of a mess. You know, we ended up breaking into three different pen names later because we had, you know, explicit sexual content with YA stuff with just all over the place.
Yeah, that was my question. But was did you start out all together or did you break it into different pen names?
We started all together and we broke into different pen names. Now our primary pen name is Karpov Kinraid. One thing we realized, Alex Lux has a lot of books, a romantic suspense, a paranormal romance, a couple standalones, and a couple romantic comedies. And those are all sexually explicit. We don't actually enjoy writing that anymore. So our KK, our Karpov Kinraid pen name, is our primary pen name now. And it has been mostly focused on fantasy and sci-fi with younger female protagonists with a particular kind of theme of some romance with a lot of big world building and kind of wish fulfillment action adventure with magic and discovery and coming of age themes. We're moving more into some suspense genre with a hint of paranormal or sci-fi elements because we really enjoy suspense. And we're moving more into standalones right now for a lot of reasons. But I think that first series, the Seduce Saga, that it really took off for us, like it literally, we published the first book in, I think, January, the next book in March of 2013, I think. And when the second book came out, we made 10 grand that month. And it was like, I mean, we were living on like food stamps. So we felt like we had just really mm-hmm. won the lottery.
Now, I sort of derailed you. Well, I just did it again. Go ahead. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead.
You were originally telling us about the analysis you did to determine what people were looking for and what sells, and I interrupted you there.
Yes.
So can you talk about how you guys went
about I derailed myself, too. Sorry about that. So, yeah, in looking at the genres, we've always tried to find, like, the niche, the thing that clicks, and the thing that's going to get people excited, like the hook for the story, whatever genre you're writing in. We also, and this is a lot of my husband's doing, analysis of story and different genres and about different genres having a particular recurring theme readers are reading for even if they don't know they're reading for. Some of them are really obvious, like in romance. Well, in erotica, you have the sex scene. In romance, you have the kind of rescue boy saving girl from shit scene. In suspense, you have the... which is different than mystery. Mystery, you have the clues, but in suspense, you have the scene of false trails, of getting a clue that's leading the wrong way. Kind of big reveals that fuck your mind. They're the mind fuck scenes. Fantasy is a hodgepodge of genres, so depending on the kind of fantasy you write, you're dealing with either the romance type scene, the rescue scene, or the wonder of, like, it's the wonder scene, you call it. It's the ooh, I get to do this brand new cool shit with magic scene. You also have like an action adventure or other kinds of scenes that fall into fantasy depending on what you're writing. Urban fantasy is a lot of the kick butt female fight scene. And so if you know the scene that you're writing for in that genre or what you're trying to get from that genre, I think it can really help, at least it has helped us to kind of know what we're writing and who we're writing it for. So when our biggest success that we've had is Vampire Girl. And it's a cheesy title, which we picked on purpose, because girl in the title sells for suspense, or was for a while, and it has a suspense element. We wanted people to have that, whatever a subconscious thing is happening when people see the word girl in the title. We wanted that for the series because it has a lot of suspense. And Vampire just makes it really clear what you're getting. But it's also kind of, it also almost undermines like the storyline a little bit, but in a way that we deliberately did. Like it makes it feel a little cliche, but you click on it kind of wondering, and then you get this story that's much bigger than the title promises. And in that series, we were going for a fantasy romance. We didn't want urban fantasy, which people sometimes call it, but it's not. And so the recurring scene in that is the rescue scene, but we twist it a little bit where she's getting rescued a lot, but she also rescues the guy a lot. And so it has a feminist twist to it. And we added other recurring scenes from other aspects of fantasy that we felt were important for this, like the wonder and the coming of age thematic element. And so we blended some genre storyline that created, I think, a really rich and interesting four-book series. Well, all but one, the poor third book, didn't launch in the right, the USA Today bestseller. existed. And it's become a book that people are reading and rereading and, you know, have tattoos on their bodies for, and it's been crazy. And so I think that's really helped us in knowing, like, okay, what kind of story are we writing and what kind of theme needs to be in this story for it to fulfill reader expectation, and then how can we fulfill it and then also do something a little different with it. And that's what we've tried to do with our books. And so each series or book we write, we try to up the game for ourselves a little bit more with not just our prose writing improving and our understanding of whatever storytelling, but also in grabbing that hook that people will keep coming back and turning pages and hopefully loving the story.
Now, I want to back up a little bit because you touched on something I think is very important, and that is understanding the tropes a given genre. So often, you know, you and I are in the same author Facebook group, and we discuss some of the mistakes we see authors making or some of the hubris that struggling authors seem to have. And one of the things we see a lot is authors saying, well, I'm going to write romance or I'm going to write some other genre, but I don't have time to read it. But I know that I'm a superior writer, ergo, I can do this. And that's obviously a mistake. But the other thing is sometimes I think writers trying to establish themselves are too eager to subvert the tropes rather than embrace them in order to engage the audience. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it goes back to you have to know the rules before you can break them. And I think you have to know how to write in a genre before you can subvert the tropes for that genre in a successful way. I don't think it's impossible to do. And I think sometimes, well, what I would say from a lot of conversations with my husband, what we've come to is some of the biggest selling books and series in the history of ever, almost all of them, I wouldn't say subvert the genre, but I think they pull from other genres. They blend genre.
So what would be some examples of that? I'm catching you.
Well, okay, some examples. Harry Potter is sort of a children's series, but it pulls in a lot of horror and fantasy, and it does so in a way that's engaging to adults. So it has some of the tropes from a couple different genres and also is written in a way to appeal to a very wide audience. The Twilight series, before Twilight came out, I can't recall, I mean, this was ages and ages ago, but it wasn't particularly popular trope to write sort of was essentially a paranormal romance, but in a YA setting for teens, but not super angsty teen. I mean, I know some people think it's super angsty teen, but it's really not as much as people think it is. They just like to hate on books that are popular now.
Yeah, there certainly wasn't any kind of phenomenon like that, even if there were some stories out there.
And a lot of the books that dealt with vampires and supernatural dealt with it from like an urban fantasy adult point of view, where there was explicit sexual content and or, you know, adult female kicking ass, killing all the bad guys and then sleeping with the other people that were sort of pseudo bad guys. This changed all that. This took like sort of a YA setting, but gave it some sort of paranormal fantasy romance feeling and made it much more epic. And I think the combination of different genres.
And almost with a dose of Judy Blume in there with the teenager and her issues and the coming of age.
Exactly. So it created a whole new thing that now everyone's doing, but that hadn't been done before. And so I think when you look at some of those kinds of books, you see that it crosses genres. And that's one thing we tried to do with Vampire Girl, for example, so a lot of our fantasies, or not a lot, but several of our fantasies, including one we have coming out this fall, they start in the real world. So people think they're urban fantasy because they just kind of throw urban onto everything that isn't starting in some mythical land, you know? But they're not. They're not urban fantasy. Though urban fantasy readers do like them. They start in the real world, but then we take the reader into a different world. It's very Narnia and Harry Potter-like, but not a lot of books do that. And so we're kind of pulling in, like, Vampire Girl had a lot of contemporary romance readers who had never read fantasy. And it gets very epic fantasy, that series, once you get into this other, completely other world, this completely fantasy world with its own world building and, you know, people and creatures and storyline and everything. But it starts out in the real world. So it's pulling in contemporary romance readers. It's pulling in fantasy romance readers. Not necessarily hardcore epic fantasy male, I never read female POV kind of fantasy readers. But everyone else that kind of sits along the edges of that, it pulled in those. And I think that's one of the reasons the book did so well. So I think if you can understand your genre, but you should also read out. Like, I think the mistake of not reading your genre that you're trying to write in is ridiculous. It's a big mistake. But there's also a mistake, I think, in not reading outside of your genre.
Absolutely.
We read books from almost every genre. Like, the only thing I probably won't read or don't read is, like, military war nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just not something that's – and actually, I can't even say that's true. I was doing research for a recent book, and I did read some military war nonfiction books, so I just lied. I think you have to read outside of your genre. And what is that old story about how – dry cleaning, maybe I'm making this up, but like dry cleaners got the idea for hanging clothes on the rotating hooks because of what meat people. You can see I'm a good writer, right? I have a lot of words, the best words, bigly words in my head.
Well, your head is full of images that you can, through your several drafts,
yeah,
put into pages.
Exactly. That's what editing is for. But from the meat industry, where they hang their meat on rotating hooks.
Oh,
I've read or heard somewhere that dry cleaning got that idea from the meat industry.
Hmm.
Well, I think that that's a really interesting kind of analogy or metaphor or something for pulling in good ideas into your own genre from other genres, from other tropes, especially if you're doing it consciously to cross-pollinate that genre with other genre readers. Because if you can do that, you know, if you write a sci-fi suspense, and you can get suspense readers reading it and sci-fi readers reading it, you've doubled your readers. So that's where I think that there's an opportunity to play in other genres or subvert, if you want to call it that. But I think you have to do it really knowingly, and you have to know the genres you're playing with really well.
Yeah, and I think some of the
And that means reading them a lot.
Yeah. I think some of the people who say they want to subvert the tropes, what they really mean is they want to reject them, and they want to write the kind of story they like to write but put it in a rough setting of whatever this new genre is. But you're right, there's study involved. You need to be intentional with it. But you talked about reading not just reading fiction, but some of the best ideas come from history, particularly medieval and ancient history. A lot of what George R. R. Martin has done mm-hmm. in Game of Thrones comes from history. For example, people freaked out. Mm-hmm. I don't know, do you watch Game of Thrones?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I figured you did. Didn't want to assume. When Arya serves
the entire series twice.
Yeah, when Arya serves a pie with the guy's sons in it, that really happened in Middle Eastern history. A lot of Game of Thrones is based on War of the Roses, but people don't realize this because they think history is boring. Well, you just got to read the right history, but you can get great ideas even from that as well. Now, I was curious. You mentioned the series that's going to start in the modern world and then jump to a fantasy world, and it's funny how that's sort of a case how things go away and come back again, because I guess back in the 70s and early 80s, there was the whole so-called world-napping novel where you would be transported to another world. Sometimes it was done in the context of a Dungeons & Dragons-type game or something. And for the longest time, readers didn't want it, and it wasn't publishable. But then you get The Magicians, where the premise is you've got this main character who loves to read those old Narnia-type books, and he's mocked for it until they find out it's real. And I think that that series has kind of started bringing that back again, and people have rediscovered their love of the Transported to Another World series. Was The Magicians part of your inspiration?
No. No, we started doing stuff like this before that came out,
okay.
At least before the TV show. I never read the books.
Well, maybe he stole it from you then.
Perhaps. No, actually, where that idea came from, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is my favorite book of all times. And I've had many different kinds of relationship with that book from when I was a kid and I was a Christian and it had a lot of religious connotation for me to when I became an adult and no longer identified as a Christian. The fact that it still had significant meaning and layers in life, like lessons embedded in it, to just being a really like fantastic story from a completely like secular, non anything point of view. I think C.S. Lewis is one of the most brilliant writers ever, despite disagreeing with him on almost everything fundamentally. Mm-hmm. he's still the best writer, one of the best writers that I can think of. And that, I think, I had a rough early life, a bit. I mean, it's all relative, right? But for me, fantasy was a way to escape the reality of my life. Now I love my life, and fantasy is a way to just keep, you know, living in it and loving it. But I'm still waiting for that door to Narnia, or my letter from Hogwarts. And I think Hogwarts did the same thing that Narnia did. It gave people an opportunity to kind of get out of their shitty war life, whether it's actual war or being in an abusive relationship like with Harry, or just feeling stuck in whatever shit you're in right then, which is, I think, 90% of the world is living that, sadly. A book like this allows you to start in that stuck place of shit and find your door to Narnia, or get your magic letter to your magic school, and go into a thing where the good and evil is a little more clearly defined, and where you have special powers to fight it, and where you get to bond with, like, cool people that become your tribe. And so even though, like, these new worlds don't offer, you know, conflict-free, utopias, because that would be a really boring – my kids keep trying to write books like this, and we keep talking about the importance of conflict in story. But what it does give you is a way of, like, an empowerment of feeling like I can finally fight this. It's not just some bills piling up from the hospital that I can't pay, or, you know, chronic medical conditions that I can't overcome. It's this bad guy that I'm going to train and kick ass and kill or something, you know? So it becomes like this, it gives our fears and our sadness and our despondence a face, and it gives us the empowerment to fight it, even if it's just in our minds or the stories. And so I think that that's where the power of those kind of stories, and that's honestly what every book, what every fiction book is, but this particular trope allows it in a very connected and clear way to have that wish fulfillment and escapism that I think a lot of people need right now.
Now, we talked about Vampire Girl. How about your science fiction? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we are not hardcore science fiction writers. Well, no, so no. People who are like, you know, the kinds of writers that write in just, you know, discussing like the flaws in your math equation for how your spaceship took off, those are not our readers. Those are not our target readers anyways. The one series we have right now that delves into science fiction actually has a fantasy understory, and that's the Nightfall Chronicles. It starts out with Court of Nightfall, and it takes place in a futuristic sort of dystopian modern world, or our world. But the twist is that historically, when there was witch trials and, you know, all the hunts for magical people and demons and Satanists and all that throughout history and all the different countries, in this world, it really was real. There was Nephilim that were part of the world, and they were being hunted, and their bloodline through mating with humans carried on and on and on. And so you get to this, like, futuristic time where it goes – it kind of reverts back to a very like, there's the four orders – like the Templars, and the world is basically ruled for the most part by the Catholic Church in this version. And the last Nephilim has been killed at the beginning of the book. There was a big Nephilim war, but there are still people with the bloodline of Nephilim, and they exhibit certain powers, paranormal powers, and they're considered the lowest of the lowest, a very hierarchical society. The science fiction part comes in where they have basically angel technology from artifacts left by the angels that they have used science to replicate and use to modify human beings who aren't born with the Nephilim blood so that they have extraordinary powers and sort of X-Men style. So it's light sci-fi with some fantasy background, and it creates this whole world, and then this girl, you know, has to do her thing and save the world and all that.
Very cool.
So that's – my first trilogy, Forbidden Trilogy, also dealt with, like, paranormal abilities, but it didn't have a fantasy backstory. It was based on science and extracting this, like – I don't even remember the science I used because it was so long ago, but there was something in the spinal fluid that they could tap to pull out these powers and use to – reproduce it, but it was basically a genetic It was more X-Files. I mean, X-Men and its genetic mutations. And that story was first thing that I published. But very light on. Interested in fantasy, and now we're getting more into suspense with a little bit of fantasy or sci-fi.
Okay. Now, I'm really interested about this process of writing with your husband. Now, first of all, did you guys start out from the beginning with the plan to write together, or do you start out doing your own thing and then join up?
I mean, I guess technically, because we both were writing before we met. So, but I'd been a journalist, but I hadn't published any fiction. And I'd been a ghostwriter and a journalist for years. And he was in college studying professional writing, but because in Canada you can't major in like fiction or study fiction writing until you've done 2 years of professional writing, which is basically boring nonfiction, and he hated it. And so when we actually met on Twitter, and we became writing partners, and we both really fell in love with each other's work. And he really inspired me to start writing fiction again. I'd been working on, you know, how like almost every writer has the one book that they start when they're like in high school and they never finish. I had that book. He had that book. We read each other's bits and pieces of books and other short stories and things. And we ended up falling in love pretty quickly. He came out to the U.S. and we started. From the very beginning, once we really got serious, right? I wrote Forbidden Mind, but then he helped me write the rest of the trilogy. And from then on, we've really, to some degree or another, written every book together.
So take us through your process from creation to finished product. How did the two of you work together on a book?
It varies a little bit by book, but the general process is either inspired by, I had this dream, I had this great idea, what could we do with it? Or we've been in, you know, or we owe our lawyer $100,000 for court fees because of a custody battle. What can we write that's going to sell big right now? That's how Vampire Girl came to be, by the way. But we basically, we'll start with a spark and we'll just talk it through. And we're always talking about books is practically our foreplay at this point. We're always talking through ideas and seeing what lands and what doesn't or what we get most excited about. And then we narrow an idea down based on what our objective is. Is our objective to stretch ourselves as writers and to write something new and different and interesting? Do we really need to hit the market hard because we have a financial obligation we need to meet immediately because we're full-time? This is it. This is what pays everything right now. Are we wanting to try a new twist on a genre? So we kind of figure out, okay, where do we want to go with this? And what usually happens is I'm very character-driven, and so I'll write, like, the first chapter from the main character's POV. Or sometimes he will. There's a couple projects he has, but it's usually me. And then we look at that character and figure out, okay, and we have kind of some basic ideas of plot. And so then we'll outline the book kind of verbally together. He'll take more detailed outline notes. A lot of times he'll do more detailed outline, and I'll work from his outline, and then he'll add to that. Or we break up chapters, and he'll write some of them, and I'll write some of them based on our strengths. He's better at writing action scenes. I'm better at writing likable characters. And then there's just nuances of things that we add to each other and help each other. By the time a book is done, we really couldn't tell who wrote what. Even if we divided up by chapters, or he did outlining and I did more of the prose, we really can't tell because in his outlines he's adding dialogue. And in my prose I'm fleshing things out, and then in the edits he's adding sections or changing things or rewriting things, and then I'm editing his edits. And so then we just go back and forth.
I sort of evolved to that too with my co-authors, where I'm creating heavy story beats, including dialogue and things like that in my outline, so it's getting some of my voice even in what I don't write on the first draft. Now, does one of you always get to be the one who's right? Say if there's a conflict, is one of you always the winner? Do you flip a coin? How does it work?
How does that work? If it's a project that one of us is like particularly, this is my baby and you're here because of the name, which we don't really have much of that but if it's split, there's one story he started that even if I took over and finished it, he would have a lot of say. And there's a book coming out this fall that I've been kind of floating in my head for a while that I'll try to do the primary prose on. In that case, we each might have a little bit of veto power in our own book, but neither of us has any real veto power when it comes to that or final say. We've never actually, in all the years we've been married and been writing together in like almost 30 books at this point, we've never actually had a situation where we didn't end up agreeing. So usually what happens is he'll say this, and he'll, for example, we're going to kill off this character. I'll be like, no, I love him, and da-da-da-da. Or this character is going to do something, or I'll read it, and I'll be like, that's not really how that character would act, though. That's not authentic. And so then we just go back and forth. And I explain my position, he explains his. By the end of the conversation, we're usually both right. And so we tweak it to reflect the best of both of our ideas. And I think in the end, it becomes better than what either of us would have done on our own.
Okay. Now, you alluded to making that business decision that we all have to make. Sometimes the project that we think is going to pay our bills is going to take precedence. How do you determine that? Is it market-driven? Is it based on what you already have in the catalog that sells? How do you identify and move forward with that?
We have to balance, I'm going to say three, but that might not actually be the number. We'll see when I get to the end of it. Like three ideas. One is, what do we know how to market? Like this is something we know we can market and market well. Two, what's selling really well right now? If we're writing fast and really needing, I know people say don't write to market. And for the most part, I would say, don't like whore yourself to write for market with something you don't want to do.
Well, don't write something you
hate. But if you're really good and
love
doing a lot of genres,
yeah, if you like it,
and there's a particular thing that'll sell better than something else and they're both fun to do, then write to market. So we look at like what's gonna be strongest in the market right now, where are the trends at the moment, and we're fast, so we can do that. And then the third is what are we gonna like, because at the end of the day, like we've written romantic comedy. In fact, the first USA Today bestseller we had was romantic comedy. Hitched. I hate writing romantic comedy. I fucking hate it. It was a great book. I love reading it. It's super funny and sexy and cute and gave us our first letters, but I will not write romantic comedy again. It's like pulling teeth. It is so challenging for me. Like, nobody gets blown up. Nobody has powers. Like, it's just so hard. Pretty much nobody dies. It's terrible. So I'm not going to write a romantic, even if romantic comedy is the shit, I'm not going to write one. So it's like really looking at, you know, what am I going to enjoy writing the most? And so, like, for example, when it came to Vampire Girl, we'd had this custody thing going on. We have our kids are our kids, but there was an issue with my ex. And so we ended up spending 2 years in court, $130,000 in court bills. We won everything. It's all fine. But it was a lot. It was hard. And we needed something to pay that off really quickly. And so when we sat down, we were going to go in a different direction. In fact, that was when we were going to start writing more suspense. But we were like, this isn't the time to experiment with a genre that we've only like dabbled in within fantasy. We should probably do something we know we can market. So that we changed directions with that. And we came up with Vampire Girl by kind of doing this exercise where we take a couple different like trope genre ideas and throw them into the pot and stir it and see what comes out. So that's how that came up. Now we're in another push where we're going to be buying a house in a few months, and we want to come out with some strong work this season, this fall. But so Of Dreams and Dragons, which is our next big launch, is a standalone that's much longer, and it's similar to Vampire Girl in the way that it starts out in this world but moves to the fantasy world, but it gets much more epic fantasy because we really wanted to have a little bit of romance but not be so fantasy romance focused. We wanted the more epic fantasy. And so we did the same thing where we like kind of assessed what we needed to do to make this a really big hit. We've also learned through Vampire Girl that a really good book trailer can kill it, can really, in the good way, can really help something sell. So that's kind of when we're writing to market, we're still writing from our heart. It's not like we are just writing for money. I mean, that's when I was writing ghostwriting, that's just writing for money. But this still comes from our heart, and we still love the work we're doing, but we're really being very targeted and smart about it. And there's a place for, like, let me try this experiment, which we did a couple, you know, we do every once in a while. We'll put out something and see, let's see how much we like writing it, how much our fans like reading it. And one of our projects that we did a couple years ago did really well, but we couldn't follow up with it at the time. So we have plans next year for a more epic fantasy saga featuring that story.
How frequently do you put out a new book, would you say?
Well, this year we've only had one out, but we'll probably have two or three more before the end of the year. So this has been a little bit of a feast and famine, hurry up and then stop for a while. I would say probably anywhere from 3 to 6. I'd have to look to see the average. I mean, we've only been writing since 2012, 2011, and we have 30, I think, out, 28.
Okay.
So I don't know. I didn't major in math and
average,
numbers.
Probably. Oh, awesome.
Yeah. We're hoping to slow down a little bit. We've actually gotten into music lately. My husband is a producer, and I sing. And so we've released a couple of singles, and we're going to have an album coming out. We're also working on TV and movie scripts and want to direct. So we've got some other plans that we're hoping to not have to write so many books every year, but we still love writing, so we'll have at least a couple.
Awesome. Now, you talked about one of your considerations being, what can we market? Now, obviously, when someone reaches the level of success that the two of you had, some of your sales are going to be self-perpetuating. But above and beyond just putting out the next book and notifying your list, what kind of things do you guys do to market?
If we're really pushing a book or a series, we'll do a trailer. But the kinds of trailers we do are expensive, so we have to be really ready to do that. The Vampire Girl trailer is all in-house. Dimitri composed the music and did the sound editing and all the things. But we bought the video for it from Shutterstock, and just, like, we didn't even have any other expenses but buying the video, and it was still a couple $1,000s to make the trailer because we didn't want to use any photography. We just wanted to use all videos so it looked like a cinematic live-action trailer. I think for us, trailers are really effective, but you have to have a good one. We also then advertise the trailer on Facebook. We do Amazon ads. We also find that doing fun giveaways on our Facebook page really go viral, like, I don't know, viral, get a lot of attention and help a lot with new launches or even just giving some exposure to backlist. We include big giveaway items that people really love, even if they don't know your books from Adam, are stuffed animals based on the books. So in Vampire Girl, there's a wolf and a dragon. Mm-hmm. So dragon and wolf stuffies are just, people die for those. Oh my gosh. Like, dude, I got it on Amazon for $20. You too can have this. they act like losing our giveaway is like the end of it. Coffee, chocolate, and, you know, book-inspired things, and then obviously signed copies of the books. So those kinds of giveaways do really, really well. And
now,
those are basically the three things.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, those are the three primary things that we use to market.
Okay, now do you do those in the context of like a Facebook party or something like that, an online launch event? Do you do it in your newsletter? How do you handle your giveaways?
We don't really do Facebook parties anymore. If we're invited to participate in one, we might, because they can be fun, but I haven't found them to be particularly effective, and they're time-consuming and emotionally draining for me, because I handle most of our social media stuff. He does our advertising and other stuff. Mostly I take a good, you know, decent picture, post it on my Facebook page, on our Facebook page, Kropotkin Raid, and within, like, an hour, it's already going crazy. I'll also probably tell the newsletter, our newsletter, that we've got a Facebook giveaway going on. Here's the link. Go check it out. And I'll tell we have some groups, a fan Facebook page group and some review groups, or one review group that I'll let people know in there. But it takes off pretty quickly on its own just from a picture.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of effectiveness just out of that Facebook page by doing, you know, I haven't given away stuffed animals, but giving away ebooks, little things like that, but just making sure you're frequently doing something to get engagement on that page. I think it can be effective. A lot of people are saying don't have a Facebook page, but I think they're more than worthwhile.
Oh gosh, we love our Facebook page. We have so much interaction on ours. And it's a great way to stay in touch with, like, personal posts about our kittens, kids, you know, stupid selfies. But it's also great when we have announcements or launch. And recently, we have we've been trying this new thing that we set up through AuthorReach, which is a new company we just kind of heard of recently. They have a newsletter thing like MailChimp, but specifically geared to authors. We haven't set up – we're just getting it set up to try the newsletter part of it. But in conversing with the guy that's helping us with all this, he told me about a bot that they're using, basically AI, through another company whose name I can't remember. But right now, if you go on our Facebook page and you message us, or if you type in the word start on any of our comments, on any of our posts, it'll trigger a thing where you can get a free ebook and a free song. And you get on this list. And so when we have our next launch or song release, I can send a personal message out to everybody on that list, and it'll just show up in their messenger as a message, like if I just went over there and personally messaged them, and it can just say, hey guys, you know, Dreams and Dragons is out. We're super excited. Here's the link. Check it out. Let me know what you think. Hope you like it. And you can even, if you go into the original system and not through AuthorReach, my understanding is you can even have it have their name, so it just looks really personal, like this personal message they just got from their favorite author. So we're going to be experimenting with that because I think people are getting burned out on newsletters, not that they're not worth building, because they are. And general posts on Facebook, you know, it's hard to reach all of your audience, but if you have a list of people who are getting it messaged to their Facebook Messenger, most people check that pretty regularly and don't ignore those messages. So the open rate and click-through rate from the small trials they've seen so far are pretty exciting. And we posted about this. Within a couple hours, we had like 600 people sign up, or 500 people. It was so I'm really excited to see what we can do with that.
That is fascinating. Well, definitely keep me posted on how that goes.
I will. I haven't announced it in any of our Facebook groups because I haven't like really tried it yet. And I didn't want to like be like, hey, guys, check all this out. And then it sucked. But right now, so far, I'm impressed with the company and their customer service. Like, this guy is setting up all of this and doing all this for me. And so far, I'm excited by the potential, because I think having something like this for a messenger is really maybe a game changer. I don't know. That could be too big of a bold word, but I don't know. I think it's moving to the direction of people and how they want to interact with, you know, with everybody in their lives right now.
Yeah, I think that's really something interesting to keep an eye on. Well, one of the things we like to do, since one of the thrusts of this podcast is indie author success, is we kind of try to bring it all together and give you a chance to give some advice to indie authors. Now, these could be, you could talk to beginning authors who haven't even published anything yet. Maybe it's struggling authors in your genre. And you might want to distill some of the things you've already said. But if you were given the chance to give some advice to indies, what would you say?
I would say do your research. Understand what makes best-selling books in your genre, what makes best-selling books in other genres. Constantly improve on your storytelling skills and your prose skills, which are different. And if you don't know the difference, then you need to do more research. Learn marketing. And honestly, this is true for non-indie authors. This is true for just anybody who wants to succeed in writing.
I agree.
And stay really flexible, because the advice I give today is going to be different than the advice I'll give in a year. And the advice that I give and use for me that works might not work for you. So I think the other thing is to experiment a lot. We've made a lot of stupid mistakes. In fact, recently we've made stupid mistakes. We tried to rebrand a series with a new author and a new pen name and covers, and it just fucked everything up. Now the both series are out under two different names because we don't know which one to pull, because people are still reading both and it's a mess. So we try things, but they fail. We try things.
But you can't know until you've tried
You can't know until you've tried it. And we're always, like, just because something works for us doesn't mean we're not going to try, like, this bot. You know, we're doing really well, but I'm still looking for new ways to integrate technology and reader preferences and the changing dynamic of how people stay in communication and how people find what they want. You know, so it's just staying open and constantly researching and studying and integrating those things into your plan. So you've got to have a great story. You've got to write reasonably well, and you've got to look good in your product, like your cover, your product description. These all have to be really good. And then you need to know how to get people's attention.
Absolutely. And, you know,
which seems really self-evident, but that's my advice.
Well, I think you have to say it, though. Yeah, it's not enough just to put it out there. And once upon a time in Kindle, it was enough to put it out at 99 cents or to put it out at free. And everything took care of itself because it was such a small pond. But that's not the case anymore. And you've got to take responsibility for your own career.
Yeah. And I think there's a tendency, I want to say with new authors, but I don't know that that's maybe new isn't the right word. I think there is a tendency with people who maybe aren't successful as an author, but who have written a little or a lot or whatever, to have this attitude of, why aren't I selling? Because my book is so much better written than XYZ. Some popular thing that nobody, you know, that they can't understand why everyone loves so much. And I think that's the attitude that's going to fuck you up and make you never succeed. Because you have, like, there's books that I've read that are very, very, very popular that I didn't particularly love, that I may even have had issues with. But I read them and I studied them to learn why they are so successful. And if you look hard enough at books that are tremendously well-selling, you will learn something about what is making them so successful. There's an addictive quality to it. There's something engaging about it. It's touching a nerve that people want touched. It's doing something for
a huge percentage of the population. Yeah, Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code, things like that. You can pick it apart and have problems with the prose, but bottom line is he wrote a story people want to read. Or Twilight.
Yeah.
50 Shades.
Exactly. Twilight, 50 Shades. Like, there's so many books. I mean, even Harry Potter got criticized for some of its prose in the early days. I remember listening to an NPR radio station that poked fun at some of the word choices and language. But it's like, if you can't read these books, or at least read one of them or some of them, and appreciate what is happening there and what's going right, instead of having this sort of arrogant attitude that, well, my prose is better, then you're not going to succeed. Because it doesn't matter how well you write, and it doesn't matter how well you tell stories. If you're not meeting a need in the reader, you're not going to sell. You have to know what need they have that you can meet, and then you have to meet. It's advertising. It's like advertising. You know, you have to know what the people need, and then you have to know how to give it to them.
Yeah, I had a sort of an experience with that in my main series. My best-selling series is sort of modern-day Indiana Jones, treasure hunt, ancient mysteries type thing. And I got several books in, and I was doing well, but I was thinking, well, you know, James Rollins is more popular than I am, and his guys are on a team. It's not just the small crew. So I segued and put my guys on a team, and the book sold really well, but a lot of people hated it because what they were looking for my books was the camaraderie between the two main characters, the treasure hunt aspect. They weren't looking for a James Rollins story from my book, so I had to come up with a reason to get them back off the team again, and I spun the team off into its own series. So sometimes we try to give the reader what they think they ought to have instead of what it is they actually want.
Yes. Oh. Or we're writing for our own personal ego. And if you're writing for your own ego, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But, like, Dimitri and I knew from the very beginning, all of our careers, writing, music, TV, and movies, none of these are hobbies for us. Like, we're doing it to succeed and make money. And to make a lot of money and succeed highly. So we aren't just doing this as, like, I have this one book in me I have to get out, or I need to write this memoir to process my own emotions. I mean, those are all valid reasons for writing a book. But if you're looking to make a career out of it, where you're really making good money that's sustainable, that you can keep making money, then you really have to look past yourself and enjoy what you're writing, yes. But you can't be writing to, like, for some other thing to impress your ninth grade English teacher or something. Like, you really have to be writing.
Work out your unresolved issues.
With commercial success in mind. And, like, people act like that's a dirty word. But, like, I want to be commercially successful, you know? I mean, I think I am, and I want to continue to be so on an even larger level. And if that, I think there's some writers that think that that's crass. And if that's you, then you're, well, then I'm not the person to ask for advice from.
Well, those people are probably not listening to this show because I said in episode one, this is primarily for people who want commercial success in indie fiction. So you are, you know, right in the sweet spot. All right. Well, we are coming up on an hour, so it's going to be time to wind it down. You've given us lots of links that we're going to put in the post on Wood on Words. But why don't you tell people where the best place is to find you online?
We're really active on Facebook at Karpov Kinrade, KarpovKinrade. And we're getting our website kind of cleaned up and updated, so that's a good place to get just all of the things, links, book orders, order of a series or whatever. And I will say that we've got, in addition to Of Dreams and Dragons coming out recently, which has dragons in it for people who like dragons, we've got some surprises this fall that we're really excited about, and some really big, fun giveaways with lots of stuffies and chocolates and coffee. So Facebook will be the place to check out that. And, press start somewhere and message us and see what our bot does.
Well, if you have any leftover coffee, you're welcome to send it my way, just so you know.
You know, what's funny is I don't even drink coffee. But I collect it for giveaways.
Hey, whatever works. All right, well, Lux, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think you've had a lot of advice that's going to help people out, and we want to wish you the best with all of your work moving forward. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully I didn't talk too fast, and I appreciate your time.